Hello and welcome to the Spiritual School Bus. I'm Mandy Hecht. I'm an ordained minister with the Canadian Baptist of Western Canada, and I drive a school bus. In Baptist churches and on the bus, it seems like everyone wants to sit in the back. You, however, are invited to take a front row seat on the Spiritual School Bus. Ruth chapter 2. Now Naomi had a relative on her husband's side, a man of standing from the clan of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. And Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi, "Let me go to the fields and pick up the leftover grain behind anyone in whose eyes I find favor." Naomi said to her, "Go ahead, my daughter." So she went out, entered a field, and began to glean behind the harvesters. As it turned out, she found herself working in a field belonging to Boaz, who was from the clan of Elimelech. Just then Boaz arrived from Bethlehem and greeted the harvesters. "The Lord be with you." "The Lord bless you," they answered. Boaz asked the overseer of his harvesters, "Who does that young woman belong to?" The overseer replied, "She is the Moabite who came back from Moab with Naomi." She said, "Please let me glean and gather the sheaves behind the harvesters." She came into the field and has remained here from morning till now, except for a short rest in the shelter. So Boaz said to Ruth, "My daughter, listen to me. Don't go and glean in another field, and don't go away from here. Stay here with the women who work for me. Watch the field where the harvesters are working, and follow along the women, after I've told the men not to lay a hand on you. And whenever you are thirsty, go and get a drink from the water jars the men have filled." At this she bowed down with her face to the ground. She asked him, "Why have I found such favor in your eyes that you notice me, a foreigner?" Boaz replied, "I have been told all about what you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband, about how you left your father and mother and your homeland and came to live with a people you did not know before. May the Lord repay you richly for what you have done. May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. May I continue to find favor in your eyes, my lord," she said. "You have reassured me and have spoken kindly to your servant, although I did not have the standing of one of your servants." At mealtime, Boaz said to her, "Come over here, have some bread and dip it in the wine vinegar." When she sat down with the harvesters, he offered her some roasted grain. She ate all she wanted and had some left over. As she got up to glean, Boaz gave orders to his men, "Let her gather among the sheaves and don't reprimand her. Even pull out some stalks for her from the bundles and leave them for her to pick up and don't rebuke her." So Ruth gleaned in the field until evening. Then she threshed the barley she had gathered, and it amounted to about an ephah. She carried it back to town, and her mother-in-law saw how much she had gathered. Ruth also brought out and gave her what she had left over after she had eaten enough. Her mother-in-law asked her, "Where did you glean today? Where did you work? Blessed be the man who took notice of you." Then Ruth told her mother-in-law about the one at whose place she had been working. "The name of the man I worked with today is Boaz," she said. "The Lord bless him," Naomi said to her daughter-in-law. "He has not stopped showing his kindness to the living and the dead." She added, "That man is our close relative. He is one of our family guardians." Then Ruth the Moabite said, "He even said to me, 'Stay with my workers until they finish harvesting all my grain.'" Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, "It will be good for you, my daughter, to go with the women who work for him, because in someone else's field you might be harmed." So Ruth stayed close to the women of Boaz to glean until the barley and wheat harvests were finished, and she lived with her mother-in-law. May the Lord bless the reading of his word. Well, when we left Naomi last week, she had just arrived in Bethlehem. She was a widow. She was bereft and empty. But not quite all the way empty. When Naomi arrives in Bethlehem after chapter 1 of the book of Ruth, she urges the women of Bethlehem to not call her Naomi any longer. She says, "Call me Mara," which means bitter. And she says, "I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi? The Lord has afflicted me. The Almighty has brought misfortune upon me." And she says all these words while Ruth, who has bound herself to journey with Naomi until the grave and beyond, is standing right beside her. And the barley harvest has just begun. And so perhaps Naomi is not quite as empty as she feels in that moment. The book of Ruth focuses on that ever-present, ever-perplexing question that plagues peoples of faith. According to Scripture, God is a God of kindness, mercy, loyalty, loving kindness, loyal, steadfast, unfailing, or just plain love. There's a lovely Hebrew word for that, hesed. But what happens when circumstances flatten us, when the waves of suffering crash over and over and over again, and everything that we once relied upon is taken from us? When we have the kind of experience that Job had, or that Naomi had, when it feels as if there is nothing left to live for, when life is so bitter that it seems to lose all kinds of meaning, what happens when it feels as though God has turned his hand against us? Had God's steadfast love run out for Naomi in the bitterness of her existence? The story of Naomi and of Ruth, sandwiched in this little book between Judges and 1 Samuel, answers this question which echoes throughout Naomi's empty soul. What does God's love look like in the midst of our tragedies? Had God's loving kindness to Naomi run out? And her answer comes not through burning bushes or walking on the sea like dry land. Her answer does not come through the voices of prophets or through visions and dreams. Her answer, in short, does not come through any kind of thing that we might recognize as a miracle. But instead, it comes through the faithfulness of God's servants, people who bear the image of God. Naomi's answer begins with the woman standing beside her as she enters Bethlehem. Naomi's answer begins with Ruth. On the road to Bethlehem, Judah, as Naomi journeyed back toward her home and her people after becoming utterly destitute in the land of Moab, she suddenly realized that while Bethlehem is home for her, it is not home for her two daughters-in-law, Orpah and Ruth. And so she sets them free. She urges them to go back. She looses them from her family ties and loyalty which bound them to her, and urge them to return to their own homes and their own families, where they would at least have the potential of a future. And so on the road to Bethlehem, Judah, those two women found themselves at a crossroad. Will they turn back to what they have left? This is, after all, the sensible option, the logical path, the path that will give them a much better chance at life beyond the difficult one that they have known in the past number of years, in which their husbands have died and left them with no children and nothing but each other, three widows scraping out a living in a society where attachment to a man was everything. On the road to Bethlehem, Orpah chooses the logical choice. Orpah chooses to accept Naomi's offer to return to her own home, where there might be another match for her, where she might have a future. On the road to Bethlehem, Orpah does what is sensible. She turns back, but then she's lost forever to the pages of Scripture. But Ruth, as she stood at the crossroad on the road to Bethlehem, with the possibility of a family and a future behind her, and only the companionship of a bitter and broken old widow ahead of her, Ruth defies logic. Ruth refuses the sensible option. Ruth binds herself to Naomi with those famous and beautiful words, "Don't urge me to leave you or turn back from you. Where you go, I will go, and where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if even death separates you and me." And so at the crossroads between Moab and Judah, Ruth chooses Naomi's part. Ruth embraces Naomi with everything that she has, everything, her past, her Moabite heritage, her constant companionship, her death, her burial, her future, all that she has been and is and will be. And when Ruth embraces Naomi, she not only embraces Naomi, but she embraces Naomi's God too. She embraces Yahweh. This is the time and the place where Ruth, who is known all throughout our book as the Moabite or the Moabitess, chooses to become an Israelite, chooses to become a follower of Yahweh. She demonstrates a change of heart, of mind, of life direction, which she expresses in her radical vow of love and self-sacrifice to Naomi. So if Naomi is a lot like Job, a picture of righteous suffering, Ruth is a lot like Abraham, the defining ancestor of the people of Israel, who followed God's call, "Go from your country, your people, and your father's household to the land I will show you." Ruth also left her country and her people and her household to the land that God would show her through Naomi. It's hard to imagine a more unlikely evangelist than Naomi. Carolyn Custis James wrote a book on Ruth, and she writes, "Resurrection power took hold of Ruth on the road from Moab to Bethlehem. There's no other way to explain what happened to her. What were the chances that she would turn to God after seeing all the bad things that happened to Naomi? And what a marvel that God chose Naomi, who had nothing good to say about him and was actually trying to send Ruth away, to be the evangelist. I love to contemplate the irony of it all, the improbability of Ruth's choice and the unlikelihood of Naomi being the one to show the way. The loving kindness and loyalty of God toward his people in general, and to Naomi specifically, had not run out. It is the kind of love that never runs dry. That's what we learn as we read the book of Ruth. God had yet more in store for Naomi, and it begins with the commitment that Ruth makes to leave her home and her family to cling to Naomi and her God. As Naomi and Ruth arrive in Bethlehem, the barley harvest has begun, and so has the rest of Naomi's story. And so has Ruth's story, who lives out her newfound commitment to Yahweh. Having thus committed herself to God and to Naomi on the crossroad to Bethlehem, Ruth lives out her new identity as a child of God. She embodies what it means to be God's true child. But she does this not by any extraordinary or superhuman means. Ruth, Naomi, and then Boaz, whom we also met in our reading this morning, are just ordinary people living their lives, dealing with the problems and making decisions that come their way. They're people who are trying to get married and raise families and trying to make ends meet and put food on the table. They're people who have to conduct business and cope with grief. Ruth shows us what it looks like to be a follower of God amid the daily struggles of living that all of us encounter. Ruth is determined to fulfill her promise to Naomi, and so her first order of business is putting food on the table. It is not an easy or a glamorous task. Many, many people around the world, in the past and even now, know the struggle that it is to feed a family. Sometimes that struggle is all-consuming. Sometimes it means working two and three jobs. Sometimes it means taking overtime shifts. Sometimes it means making hard choices like putting your children in daycare so that you can work to provide a meal for them. But it has to be done. And that's what I mean when I say that the story of Naomi and Ruth is lived out in the lives of ordinary people, living out their faith as they go about life. We might say that Naomi won the lottery, in a manner of speaking, when Ruth committed herself to Yahweh and to Naomi on the road to Bethlehem. But still, Naomi and Ruth are not living high on the hog. They're not enjoying a carefree existence. Hashtag blessed. They arrive in Bethlehem and they need to eat. And so Ruth takes on the only kind of job that's available to people like her, the poor who have no resources of their own. They go in the fields where people are harvesting. They go along behind the harvesters, and they pick up whatever scraps are left over from the harvest. Now, this is a command to the people of Israel that began in Deuteronomy 24. The Lord instructs his people, "When you are harvesting in your field, do not overlook a sheaf, do not go back and get it. Leave it for the foreigner, the fatherless, and the widow, so that the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hands. When you beat olives from your trees, do not go over the branches a second time. Leave what remains for the foreigner, the fatherless, and the widow. When you harvest the grapes in your vineyard, do not go over the vines again. Leave what remains for the foreigner, the fatherless, and the widow. Remember that you were slaves in Egypt. That is why I command you to do this. So even while this was a command enshrined in the Torah, in God's law that he gives to his people, we should not see gleaning as glamorous or easy work. People who gleaned were often mistreated. It was hard to gather enough. People who gleaned often ended their days hungry. And a landowner was within his rights to keep them off his land or to kick them out if that was his wish. And people who hired to harvest the grain could be rough. And of course, the gleaner was not alone on the land that he or she gleaned. There was competition from other people, and you might run up against another gleaner who was stronger or more aggressive or just hungrier than you are. And it could get physical. You could get shoved around. And it was entirely possible that Ruth would spend her entire day gleaning and not come home with enough food to feed herself and Naomi. It's probably quite easy for us to underestimate the danger that Ruth was in. She had numerous strikes against her. She was a foreigner. As we said throughout this entire book, she's referred to as the Moabite, in case we forget where she comes from. She's a woman, she's a widow, and she's been married for 10 years and not been able to bear children. She's a woman trying to make her way in a man's world. And unattached women were particularly vulnerable as gleaners. And this story makes it quite clear because both Naomi and Boaz warn Ruth repeatedly that she might be bothered, reproached, or rebuked by men. Ruth may be in the midst of living out her identity as God's child, be trying to put food on the table to make sure that Naomi doesn't starve, but none of that discounts the fact that Ruth is very vulnerable and utterly reliant upon the kindness of strangers in order to do any of this. And this is the point in the story where another person is introduced. It just so happens that as Ruth goes out to glean in order to feed herself and her mother-in-law, vulnerable though she is, she ends up gleaning in the field of Boaz, who's a relative of Naomi. Naomi's answer to the question if God's loving kindness toward her has run out is answered first in the face of Ruth's faithfulness, and then it is answered in the face of Naomi's relative, Boaz. One writer describes the scene like this. Typically, when harvesting a field, hired men went first, grasping handfuls of grain stalks with one hand and cutting them off at the base with a sickle, and then laying the cut stalks on the ground. And then female workers followed behind, gathering and binding cut grain into bundles to be carried to the threshing floor, where raw kernels of grain were separated from the husks. And gleaners came last and were permitted into the field only after both teams of hired workers finished bundling sheaves of grain, and they were removed from the field. But Ruth requests that Boaz suspend this long-established practice for her. She doesn't want to just pick up leftover scraps for Naomi. She wanted to feed her mother-in-law, and so she makes a proposal to ensure that both she and Naomi would have enough to eat. She asked to go and glean among the sheaves behind the harvesters. That's in verse 7 of our chapter. In other words, Ruth asked to go out where gleaners were not permitted, to work among the harvesters, where plenty of newly cut grain lay waiting to be gathered into bundles. Robert Hubbard writes, with admiration, "Given the meager, fair gleaners probably gathered, one suspects a concern to increase her chances of gleaning enough to provide for Naomi and herself. And Ruth showed herself to be anything but a modest, self-effacing foreigner. Rather, she emerges as courageous, if not slightly brash. Probably aware of possible rejection or ostracism, she willingly takes a sizable risk in order to benefit her mother-in-law. Again, she lived out her fidelity and presented a model of risk-taking devotion to be emulated." Plucky Ruth makes this unconventional, at best, request in order to have the best chance of not returning home to Naomi hungry. And it turns out that her request comes to exactly the right person, Boaz, who is described in our story as a man of standing, wealthy, and influential. And he not only agrees to her request, but he goes on further than that. He feeds Ruth lunch. He allows her access to the water that the harvesters have drawn. And he takes some of the risk out of Ruth's position by protecting her from the rough edge of the harvesters who work for him.
And not only this, he invites her to glean only in his field from that point on. So chance brings Ruth to Boaz's field. Or was it strictly chance? There's a saying that goes like this: a coincidence is a miracle where God chooses to remain anonymous. And so it would seem to be here. God touches Naomi through Ruth's devotion, and God protects Ruth through another of his servants, Boaz. See, even though Ruth is an unlikely person to be a recipient of God's graciousness, God's care, God's loving kindness, having only just committed her life to God when she followed Naomi instead of returning to Moab at the crossroad, it turns out that God is looking out for her too, just as he was watching over Naomi. Boaz says to Ruth, "May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." God spread his wings of protection over Ruth, who was once an outsider, an enemy of the people of God, and tucks her safely under his loving wings. And so it is at the end of this remarkable day that Ruth returns home with her sack full of grain. An ephah she gathers, we're told, which, when scholars who know about this sort of thing convert it to modern-day measurements, say represent between 30 and 50 pounds of grain when it's all tallied, which is an extraordinary amount for one day's work. If you convert that into the wages that would have been paid if Ruth had gotten herself hired on as a harvester, she made roughly the equivalent of half a month's wages or more. In one day, as one writer says, she raked in a minimum of 15 times what Boaz's harvesters were pocketing as a fair day's wage. So Ruth comes home carrying more than she or Naomi could ever imagine when she went out that morning. And not only this, Ruth comes home with the leftovers of the lunch that Boaz graciously served her, and she gives them to Naomi. One person pointed out that even if Ruth had come home with this great richness of grain and the women had to convert that to a meal for that night, there would have at least been a few hours' work in trying to do that. But Ruth comes home not only with tons of grain, but a hot meal to serve right then and there. This is grace upon grace for Naomi, who is hollowed out by grief, certain that God has turned his hand against her. Again, Carolyn Custis James writes, "Prosperity tends to dull our senses to the presence of God's chesed, or loving kindness, in our lives. But when trouble strikes, and you're sitting in the darkness with a heart that aches for him, the slightest sign of his presence is monumental. A load of grain, a cooked meal. This sends a signal, faint though it may be, that God is here and he hasn't forgotten." Naomi's experience is a lot like watching a heart monitor gone flat and then suddenly seeing a flicker of a pulse. It's an exhilarating moment, the best possible news for despairing Naomi, for she knows that God's loving kindness is still here, and it's still meant for her. In fact, this is the point in the story where we see the beginning of hope in Naomi's soul. She sees what Ruth has brought home, and she says, "Why, God bless that man. God hasn't quite walked out on us after all. He still loves us in bad times as well as good." Here Naomi begins to see that God hasn't abandoned her, but is still alive and well and working in her life and caring for her, shining his steadfast and loyal love on her, just as he always has. But again, we notice that God works not through the miraculous, not through the rending of the heavens or the moving of mountains. Instead, it's accomplished through the faithfulness and even the chutzpah of Ruth, and through the care and attention and protection of one of Naomi's relatives, Boaz. That's part of what it means when we say that we're created in the image of God, that we can be the face of God to one another. As Carolyn James points out, more often than not, when we dust for God's fingerprints, we come up with the prints of one of his image bearers. Is God working in the fields of Bethlehem? Yes. But what's visible to our eyes is Ruth bending over the cut grain, and Boaz and his workers making sure she gets as much as she can carry. But the story contains even more powerful and touching evidence of God's hand at work through his image bearers. God so often comes to us in the help of another person. How has God come to you lately, or at times of despair in your life? Can you think of a time when a person that you knew stepped in with just the right words of encouragement, just the right kind of help, just the right kind of offer, just the right kind of smile, just when you needed it? When someone has shown up for you by giving you their time or their ear or their resources when you needed just that? When you count your blessings, be sure not to forget to count the face of God as seen in the love of other people. And we should note one more thing here as we watch Naomi, who began her story at an end, emptied out, but as we see her slowly begin to fill again. Even though Ruth comes along with a load of grain and a promise of more to come and a hot meal, this doesn't change a whole lot about what the women have gone through, the things they have experienced. In short, a boon here does not erase the pain of the past. Naomi and Ruth still teeter on the edge of poverty. Naomi and Ruth still go to sleep every night alone. They have lots of reason to weep. Naomi will have to sit at home waiting and worrying, while Ruth will still have to go out every day to glean enough to feed them. We don't see a magical restoration of all things that they have lost. And that is the way of life, isn't it? Naomi's story has both pain and grief that exist alongside love and care. Having one doesn't change the other. In life, we have both good times and bad. We have God's loving kindness and we have heartache. When we did our series on the Psalms, we learn and we listen also to the stories of Job in Scripture and of Naomi and of Ruth and of Boaz. We learn that the Bible never promises us a trouble-free life. As Eugene Peterson writes, no literature is more realistic and honest in facing the harsh facts of life than the Bible. At no time is there the faintest suggestion that the life of faith exempts us from difficulties. On every page of the Bible, there is recognition that faith encounters troubles. But better than health and wealth, better than a trouble-free existence, God promises us this. Even in the darkness, God is with us. God with us. We are not alone down here. The whole gospel is that God is with us. Jesus was called Emmanuel, which means God with us. John Wesley's dying words were, the best of all, God is with us. God doesn't shelter us from trouble. God doesn't magically manipulate everything to suit us. But the glorious with us is unassailable, unchangeable, the only fact that matters. God is with us even though joy and pain exist side by side every day of our lives on this earth. And God often comes to us in the face of another person. This is what it means to live out our lives as children of God. And this is the beginning of the shift in the story of Naomi, who for the first time begins to feel less empty and more hopeful. What will the next chapter hold for Ruth, for Boaz, and for Naomi? I urge you to stay tuned because we're going to find out next week. Would you pray with me? God of steadfast love, of loving kindness, of faithfulness and loyalty, we thank you for all the ways that you are present with us. Sometimes the darkness of our lives, sometimes circumstances make us question whether or not you are really for us, whether you are really out there, and whether you really care. But you work in our ordinary lives, bringing joy and pain into the same picture. And often you work through ordinary people like Ruth and like Boaz who love you and desire to live out their commitment to follow you by loving others. Help us to see you in the face of those around us, and help us to come to others in the same way, to offer the loving presence of God, the love of Jesus, in whatever circumstances people find themselves going through. We ask these things through Jesus, who loved us and gave himself up for us. Amen.
This has been the Spiritual School Bus. Thanks for listening. For more Spiritual School Bus, visit www.pastormandy.com. This recording is copyright 2017 by Mandy Hecht and may only be copied or redistributed by express written permission. Thank you and have a blessed week.
As you go this week, may the love of the Father, the tenderness of the Son, and the presence of the Spirit gladden your heart and bring peace to your soul this day and all days. Amen. Go in peace.